toxicology. Imagine, if you will, an explorer yourself, and perhaps put yourself maybe 100 years ago. And you're exploring continents perhaps that aren't your own, the African continent, for example. You, in your course of your explorations and going from village to village, you come across a village where a good percentage of the people have a substantial physical deformity. There's obviously questions why perhaps this village, this part of the country that you're exploring, or the continent you're exploring, has this malformation and perhaps not others. This puts us in the frame of mind perhaps to be detectives of human disease, and especially in this case, for today's lecture, foodborne disease. What we're going to do today in today's lecture is talk about naturally occurring toxicants, toxicants that occur naturally in many foodstuffs across the globe, and how they perform in their role as etiologic agents of foodborne disease. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to do is we're going to examine the etiology or causation of human disease as it is related to naturally occurring foodborne toxicants. We're going to try to understand the complex nature of foods in terms of their chemical makeup. We tend to think of foods in terms of their protein and carbohydrates. We've introduced that in the plant kingdom we have these secondary chemical compounds. For various reasons, these are typically the chemical compounds that cause foodborne toxicant-induced disease. We're going to explore a range of foodborne disease, and what we're going to do, or what you're going to do perhaps as this explorer, is try to do a little bit of detective work. You've got a disease manifestation. What in the local diet is perhaps causing that disease manifestation? We're going to explore some of the major foodborne diseases, including goiter, tropical ataxia neuropathy, or TAN, tropical amblyopia, lathrism, a very famous disease, and some of their linkages in terms of the chemical linkages to foodborne toxicants. We're going to finish off looking at a range of natural food toxicants that exist out in the human diet and their direct involvement in human disease, not necessarily in a disease classification, but sometimes a grouping of diseases. Now, in terms of the complexity of food, most of us understand the carbohydrates, proteins, lipids segments in terms of the nutrient value of food, the most important part of it, why we get our energies and the synthetic precursors to the molecules of life from our diet. Less concerned, perhaps, are we about the non-nutrient aspects of the food, although sometimes the non-nutrient aspects actually drive us. It's the color, the taste, unfortunately, sometimes these secondary compounds also are intoxicating. The non-nutrient aspects of food, or we can have as food additives, where we combine things either in low-scale sort of food preparation or very exotic or synthetic food additives. These can occur as secondary chemicals that are natural. It can also be contaminants or processing chemicals. But in terms of the numbers of non-nutrient chemicals that we find in different foods, give you a range, these can be in the hundreds, and these are the chemicals that we've been able to identify. And typically, it's a real challenge to find out what chemical of this entire range is actually the active ingredient, if you will, or the disease vector in terms of foodborne intoxication, okay? This also gives you an idea as we go back to revisiting things like food additives and even pesticide residues in food, and as well environmental contaminants, that it is a challenge to decipher this complex makeup of chemicals, this consortium of chemicals, to find out again the one that we are looking for. And this is the challenge of analytical toxicology. So I would imagine that you, if you were an explorer without the tools of modern analytical toxicology, your task of finding the causes of a foodborne intoxication would be a particular challenge. So in a certain sense, we should all have a tremendous amount of respect for the scientists and the physicians, the public health officials that decades ago, perhaps even several hundred years ago in some cases, linked particular types of food to particular disease manifestations. Now, in terms of the natural toxicants in human disease, we're going to go through several, including the classification of compounds that cause goiter or goitrogens. We talked briefly in several segments, several lectures, about cyanogenic glycosides. We'll talk about the causation of latherism. We've introduced in a couple of slides in various presentations in this course lectins and their toxic properties, as we have also talked about various types of alkaloids. We'll repeat some of those to do emphasis, but to draw attention to its physiological effects. We'll introduce protease inhibitors and vasoactive amines. We've briefly talked about vasoactive amines, but we haven't referred to them as vasoactive amines, and so we'll talk about them and how they change your physiology. Now, goitrogens is a very visible disease manifestation. This class of chemicals contribute to the growth of goiters, and goiter is a very large growth on the thyroid, as seen in this particular image. It's a fairly noticeable disease manifestation. Goitrogens come to us from compounds in the cruciferae, the brassica species, cabbage, kale, turnips, typically in the seeds and not much in the leaves. If you combine presentation of these foodborne chemicals with iodine deficiency, this will enhance the presentation of a goiter endpoint. Now, the cruciferae are the class of plants that actually have naturally occurring glucosinolates. These are thioglucosides. They're characteristic of these plants. The diets of many people in many parts of the world have glucosinolates in there because they have cruciferous plants in their diet, whether it be the mustards and the hot spices that we eat here in this country or in the East, cabbage and root vegetables in Europe and the Americas, various oils like rapeseed oil, where the various cultivars currently used for oils such as canola oil or Canadian oil is a rapeseed oil where the glucosinolates have been bred out of it, so it no longer is what would be regarded as a toxic food oil. These are undesirable compounds because of the toxicity, the bitter taste of this compound, and the toxicity of the breakdown products, and these breakdown products are of concern in terms of goiter development. Goitrogenic compounds, or goitrins, are formed from these breakdown products of glucosinolates by thioglucosidase. The metabolites are acted on include nitriles, thiocyanates, and oxazolidine. Now, goitrins work on the thyroid, and we know that the thyroid gland actually excretes several thyroid hormones that are very active in terms of hormonal balance in the human body. Thyroxine, triiodothyronine, and thyroglobulin are the main hormones associated with the thyroid. It's controlled by the hypothalamus and the pituitary. The hypothalamus produces thyrotropin-releasing hormone, or TRH. This stimulates the pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH. And it's going to be helpful because of the jargon, the medical jargon, and the number of syllables in these to use the abbreviations. Now, TSH will promote the uptake of iodine and the synthesis of TH and the release of TY and triiodothyronine, which feed back to reduce the TSH. The thyroid hormones also affect oxygen consumption, cardiovascular function, neuromuscular activity, cholesterol metabolism and cerebral function, as well as growth and development. So this is an important thyroid system, a hormonal system, in terms of growth and development of humans. Now, goitrogen and thiourea inhibit TY synthesis, and what happens is the thiocyanates and the oxazolidine and nitriles inhibit uptake of iodine by the thyroid. And so the lack of iodine causes this physical enlargement, and it causes this tissue to hypovascularate, to trap more iodine. And that yields this growth referred to as goiter. Now, in terms of testing for presence of goitrogens in the diet and the presentation of the goiter disease, typically it's associated with a clinical analysis of the weight and the histology of the thyroid, the growth rate of the patient, the animal, in terms of perhaps being stunted in growth because of the importance of thyroid hormones to growth and development, as well as the iodine concentration in the blood and in the thyroid tissues. There is a clinical measurement diagnostic in terms of feeding the individual or dosing the individual with iodine compounds and measuring that uptake, and that's typically done with radioactive iodine. Now, in terms of the presentation of another sort of foodborne disease, cyanogenic glycosides are a category that is widespread because of the widespread consumption of many plants that produce these chemical compounds. Primary in this is cassava root, which is a staple in Africa and in South America and a little bit in Asia. There are various glycosides associated with these, amygdalin, linamarin, durin, linamarin in the lima bean. These glycosides have a toxic endpoint because they can produce hydrogen cyanide, and cyanide will interact with oxygen transport in critical systems. Cassava root, also known as the manioc or yucca, depending upon where you're at, is a woody shrub. It's a perennial. The root is actually harvested. There are many varieties out there, some more bitter than others, and the bitterness is typically associated with higher levels of cyanide compounds. It's an annual crop, and various cultivars coupled with environmental conditions such as drought and food preparation will actually be significant for whether or not the cardiac glycoside level is high or low. Now, the toxic chemical in cyanogenic glycosides is hydrogen cyanide, and this HCN is released when the plant is chewed or chopped up. What happens is the physical action releases a couple of enzymes, beta-glucuronidase and hydroxynitrile lysase are released. These act synergistically to release the HCN in the gut. This is a basic generic chemical structure of a cyanogenic glycoside. Now, in terms of food preparation, communities and cultures that use cassava root know that there needs to be certain types of preparation to remove the toxicants. What happens in terms of preparation is that especially the larger roots need to be soaked in water, chopped in water for a period of time. This hydrolyzes some of the HCN and releases it. The cassava flour is sometimes ground and then treated in water prior to use. The intestinal bacteria, or what the active agent in terms of residual cyanogenic glycosides that might be in there converting it to HCN, even if the enzymes have been deactivated by soaking in water. Another vector for cyanogenic glycosides in the diet is Laetril. This is actually used as a drug. It's an anti-cancer compound of only marginal repute. It's not approved in the U.S. It's extracted from apricot pits, and there have been instances of several deaths associated with this compound. Now, in terms of the mechanism of acute cyanide poisoning, what happens is it shuts down cellular respiration and therefore energy metabolism in mitochondria. It does this by binding ferric iron. The binding capacity of cyanide or cyanates to iron is substantial, and it can't then be used for transport of oxygen, so it's a competitive inhibition. It binds iron on the cytochrome oxidase in the Krebs cycle. The minimum lethal dose is about 0.5 to 3.5 milligrams of HCN per kilogram of body weight. Now, the symptoms of acute cyanide poisoning are muscular paralysis, mental confusion, respiratory distress. It's typically presents with rapid onset. The treatment, interestingly enough, if we recall our conversations about nitrite toxicosis, where nitrate and actually reduction to nitrite actually is an oxidizing agent that oxidizes ferrous iron to ferric iron. In fact, in acute cyanide poisoning, the antidote, if you will, the treatment is perhaps another toxicant. We use nitrite to convert hemoglobin with ferrous iron to methemoglobin, ferric iron. And what this particular chemical reaction does is it releases the cyanide from the cytochrome oxidase. What you can do then in terms of follow-up therapies, if thiosulfate is around, thiosulfate will bind with cyanide to form a more innocuous chemical called thiocyanate that is non-reactive in terms of cytochrome oxidase in the irons. Now, in terms of chronic cyanide poisoning, this is quite a bit different. This occurs in areas of cassava in the diet, and so this is long-term exposure, chronic exposure. It's not particularly well understood and may be more complex than cyanogenic glycosides. There are two disorders associated with chronic cyanide poisoning from cassava. This is tropical ataxia neuropathy and tropical amblyopia. Now, TAN, or its common name Kanzo, occurs in many tropical areas. It's most prevalent in West Africa. It's an atrophy of the optic nerve, ataxia, or inability to walk, and mental disorders are some of the clinical signs associated with Kanzo. There's a high prevalence of goiter in these individuals. What we find in terms of clinical observations is that there are low levels of sulfur-containing amino acids in the individuals affected with this particular disease, and there's elevated plasma thiocyanate, which is a goitrogen. Now, in terms of some of the dietary modifiers that may impact chronic cyanide poisoning, we find that if there is adequate iodine in the diet, there is no goiter. And by the way, most of you that buy salt, notice that commercially it's sold as iodized salt. This iodization, this food additive, if you will, of common table salt is closely related to the need to put iodine into diets that are deficient in that particular mineral. Malnutrition in terms of chronic cyanide poisoning impact. Malnutrition increases the neurological effects. Protein deficient diets also modify it in terms of lack of these particular sulfur containing amino acids. And these help convert cyanide to thiocyanate in terms of the chemical reactivities. Now, the second category of disease is tropical amblyopia. This is an atrophy of the optic nerve. It yields blurred vision and ultimately blindness. Africa and South America, where cassava is a significant staple in the diet, are the primary geographical locations for this particular disease. It is reproducible in lab animals. The next category of disease that we're going to talk about in terms of linking a particular foodstuff or foodborne toxicant to disease is Lathyrism. Lathyrism results from the consumption of certain types of peas, especially Lathyrus sativus. These are referred to by common names as grass peas or blue sweet peas. They're primarily restricted to various areas where this is a part of the diet in Asia and Africa. This is a very well-known neurodegenerative disease. It results from the presence of two compounds in these peas. There's an enzyme inhibitor, we'll refer to it as BAPN, I'll show you the structure here momentarily, and also a neurotoxic amino acid, ODAP, and again, we'll show you that here in a moment. This is a popular food plant, not only for human consumption, but for food animal consumption, because it's a hardy plant and very drought resistant. Because of the prevalence in the history of Lathyrism, new cultivars of related plants are being developed to minimize the amounts of these particular chemical compounds, these naturally occurring toxicants in these feedstuffs. Now, Lathyrism has two forms of this particular disease: osteolathyrism, which occurs mostly in animals, and neurolathyrism, which presents in humans. Now, in osteolathyrism, we find bone deformations, a characteristic weakness in arterial walls and connective tissues. This is typically, in terms of dose response studies, been associated with the chemical BAPN or beta-L-glutamyl aminopropionitrile. And this is shown structurally down in the bottom here. This, again, is a component of these peas. Osteolathyrism, in terms of the mechanism, BAPN will inhibit lysyl oxidase enzymes. And this particular enzyme is needed to help cross-link collagen. And collagen is a structural component, and this helps us in terms of tissues and strength. It's a main component of various connective tissues and bones, and that's why you get the disabilities associated with the structural disabilities. Neurolathyrism is what presents most commonly in humans. Again, this comes from the chronic consumption of the sativus variety. It presents with a paralysis of the legs, followed by general weakness and muscular rigidity. Some refer to it as a young man disease, and this may be because of the relative dietary loading in terms of body size and during the developmental cycle of individuals. There appears to be a sudden onset of the disease that starts with calf muscle spasms. There has not been an adequate animal model developed for neurolathyrism. In terms of its presentation in humans, it's been associated with ODAP, or oxal alpha diaminopropionic acid, ODAP. I give you the structure here on this particular slide. In terms of neurolathyrism in humans, the etiologic agent may be OPAP. It's found with this particular species of peas. OPAP interferes with normal function of the nerve synapse. It inhibits uptake of glutamic acid. There is no animal model in terms of a true understanding of this particular disease. Another sort of presentation of disease is from neurotoxic cholinesterase inhibitors. In our target organ toxicology and in several case studies that we've presented, we've talked about various types of cholinesterase inhibitors, especially those that present in the human diet. They're found in a variety of plants, including the alkaloids in potato and tomato plants and eggplants as well. We find it originally in terms of the prototypical cholinesterase inhibitor in the West African calabar bean that we talked about in one of our case studies, because we talked about the physostigmine drug that has been used as a cholinesterase inhibitor when we have a patient that has been exposed to cholinergic type toxicants. This particular phytochemical is a natural carbamate. Remember that carbamates are a class of cholinesterase inhibiting pesticides. And so in a certain sense here, this is a natural carbamate, therefore a natural insecticide that is present in a foodstuff. In terms of other cholinesterase inhibitors in the human diet, from the solani, we have the solanine, which is the most studied. This comes to us in potatoes. I have a structural representation of that molecule on this slide. In the earliest parts of this century and the previous century, potatoes in many cultures, Western cultures especially, were considered to be toxic, because the cultivars at that time had relatively high levels of solanine, and it did present in terms of the normal presentation of cholinesterase inhibition and just generalized illness, headaches associated with the alkaloid levels. Now, the glycoalkaloids in potatoes run from 20 to 100 parts per million wet weight. FDA has an upper tolerance of 200 parts per million. We recall in terms of our discussion here, in terms of the breeding by traditional breeding of a potato variety called Lenape that was actually presented for approval as a chipping variety potato to USDA until it was discovered that it had significant amounts of solanine alkaloid greater than 300 parts per million. Therefore, this particular variety was withdrawn from the marketplace. The greatest concentration of potato alkaloids, and solanine is one of them, is in the peel and around the sprouts. What Mom told you about greening is in fact true, and about sprouted potatoes, that they have enhanced amounts of these alkaloids. Is it going to harm you significantly? Probably not. Might it give you a tummy ache or a headache? Possibly so, depending upon your particular sensitivity. The solanine levels are increased with some light, and so that's why you store potatoes in a dark space. If you take a russet Burbank potato and put it in the light for 5 days, you stimulate remembering that a potato is a living organism, that it responds to that light and starts its production. The solanine levels start rising 250 to 700 parts per million in 5 days. So the toxicity marker that we have is greening in terms of potential for solanine. What we find in terms of solanine in human foods, it does have documented human toxicity and death. Potato sprouts have high concentration. Sprouted potatoes and green potatoes all have higher levels than recommended. The presentation of disease includes gastric pain, nausea, vomiting, hyperesthesia, increased and accelerated respiration. There have been about two of six deaths in terms of people that get exposed to high concentrations in potatoes. Now, in terms of a case study, this was a case with potatoes that had 420 part per million total alkaloid content. About 50% of the alkaloid in these potatoes was solanine. In this case, it was 200 of the 420 parts per million. With that calculation, you'd only need to consume 1 kilogram or 2.2 pounds of potato for toxicity only due to solanine. This may also act synergistically with other glycoalkaloids or additively with other glycoalkaloids like chaconine. The animal LD50 for solanine is 500 to 1,000 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. So it's going to be hard to get a significant LD50 type dose in terms of humans from consumption, but probably enough to make you quite ill. Our next category of naturally occurring toxicants that we are concerned with in human disease are vasoactive amines. We've talked about a few of these in the course so far. What we find, these compounds are the highest in aged cheese, beer, and wine, and they are responsible for some people's intolerance or food intolerance associated with these particular food groups. There are lower levels, but they're still present in some foods such as banana, tomato, avocado, spinach, and oranges. We find them in spoiled meat. If you remember our food allergy discussions and the presentation of scromboids and scromboid toxins for the disease manifestation called scromboid toxicosis, these are vasoactive amines, primarily histamine. These amines associated with vasoactive amines are sometimes also referred to as pressor amines because they do impact, cause vasoconstriction and hypertension or increased blood pressure. They're also called catecholamines. We find them in meat and fish via bacterial action and the initial states of spoilage. Putrescine and cadaverine are two vasoactive amines. In banana and avocado, they present as dopamine and tyramine, tyramine being one of the ones that's quite high in some foods. The catecholamine neurotransmitters that are found in foods are norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin, and the structures of these vasoactive amines are at the bottom of this slide. Now, we got a problem with vasoactive amines because of their metabolism and its effects on people using certain types of medications. Vasoactive amines are acted on by monoamine oxidase, MAO. This particular enzyme is widely distributed in the body. It's important in many biotransformations. It does impact vasoactive amines by breaking them down. Some individuals that have clinical depression are treated with drugs called MAO inhibitors. You sometimes will see labels on foods that might have a high level of vasoactive amines, warning individuals that are on these drugs that there is the presence of these particular chemicals. When you do have a co-exposure to vasopressive amines in food, mostly tyramine, perhaps in cheese, what you find is that the MAO inhibitors actually decrease the ability to biotransform and degrade these amines, and therefore they can have all of the physiological effects, the increase in blood pressure and perhaps hyperventilation. In terms of some of the mechanisms of vasoactive amines, when we study tyramine, we find that it has a little bit of an indirect action. It actually displaces normal catecholamines in nerve granules. I show a picture here of a nerve granule. It can lead to chronic hypertension. This can be a severe presentation in the presence of MAO inhibitors. The vasoactive amines are found in food at relatively, in some foods at relatively high concentrations, especially cheese. Tyramine, 2 to 2,000 parts per million, avocado at 25 parts per million. We find serotonin in banana pulp at 30 parts per million in avocado. And typically most food sources are less than 10 parts per million. And finally, in terms of some of the symptoms of vasoactive amines, hypertension can be mild to severe depending upon your particular sensitivity. It can be linked to migraine headaches. These food groups are some of the foods that are counseled to individuals in terms of food avoidance for response to migraine headaches. Rarely you can see the presentation of intracranial bleeding or death with populations that are very sensitive to this class of compounds. Our next category of naturally occurring food toxicants is the pyrrolizidine alkaloids. If you recall, we've spoken of the PAs several times in food toxicology this semester. This presents itself as a problem in food animal forage because grazing animals do have access to some of the plants, the toxic plants that do contain PAs. But we do get them into human subpopulations through exposure via either a toxic incident. We'll talk about a case study that happened in Tajikistan about a decade ago, or through cultural food types, for instance, Native Americans or other sort of subgroups that actually eat specific foods, and those foods happen to be relatively high in pyrrolizidine alkaloids. These levels, these alkaloids can occur in some plants at significantly high levels, about 5% dry weight. There are over 100 different compounds, so there's a great diversity of chemical structure and outcome. With the PAs, that outcome is typically associated with hepatotoxicity in some form. Most human exposure does occur from herbal teas. We talked about comfrey tea that is not commonly available nowadays, but you can still find it being sold. This does have pyrrolizidine alkaloids in it. Typically, though, what you find in terms of human toxicosis is crop or foodstuff contamination. We do have the ability to have low-level exposure in terms of the metabolites from milk or meat, but tea is usually the main vector in terms of the fragrances and tastes of some of the plants for common tea or medicinal herbal tea applications. One of these is bush tea use in Jamaica. There is a decreased use of comfrey. Comfrey has astringent properties. It still is used in wound dressing. One of the concerns we have over pyrrolizidine alkaloids is the carcinogenicity because of its reactivity with liver hepatocytes. One of the ways we see the progression of liver toxicity is through veno-occlusive disease with pyrrolizidine alkaloids. This is an occlusive lesion that is produced in some of the hepatic veins, occlusive lesions being lesions that block the flow. This particular obliterating endophlebitis actually stops or inhibits flow of blood into the liver. It leads to edema, narrowing and occlusion of the lumen or the pathways within the liver, atrophy, and finally necrosis of liver cells from lack of energy resources due to blocked blood flow. Portal hypertension in terms of the backup of blood flow from the portal vein is another diagnostic criteria for veno-occlusive disease. In Tajikistan in 1992, there was an episode of widespread pyrrolizidine alkaloid toxicity. What happened in this particular case is there was a military blockade that essentially ended with a late wheat harvest. The weeds were able to thrive in the wheat fields, and the wheat was contaminated with the seeds of heliotropium. This is a particular alkaloid, pyrrolizidine alkaloid generating species. The first cases of illness occurred about 6 weeks after contaminated bread was consumed by individuals. By the spring of 1993, there had been more than 3,900 cases of illness. Patients in stage one of illness had abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting. In stage two, they had enlarged livers. In stage three, they had ascites or an extended distended abdomen. In the final stage, there was hepatic encephalopathy, essentially necrotizing destruction of the tissue of the liver itself. The case fatality in this particular incident, the ratio of fatalities was 1.3%, and the fatalities appeared to increase with age. Another class of compounds that has direct impact on human disease, and this is one that is under study, are the anti-nutritional compounds known as protease inhibitors. These particular compounds are found in legumes, in grains, potatoes, eggplants, and onions. Their mode of action is to inhibit gastric enzymes that break down various proteins such as trypsin or protease type enzymes. The toxicity studies that we found have been in animals. We really don't know how these chemicals, these protease inhibitors, affect humans. It's somewhat unclear. What we do find is that there is evidence for pancreatic hypertrophy, where we find a hypersecretion of amino acid-rich proteins. This will lead to an amino acid deficiency and some growth retardation due to a declined nutritional status. We see that this particular mode of action and disease endpoint has a similar mechanism of latherism. There are other possible natural toxicants in the human diet, too many to talk about in a class like food toxicology. Some of these in terms of ones that we use quite often or exposed to quite often, caffeine, it's an alkaloid, various chemical compounds in terms of flavors, fragrances, and spices, licorice, nutmeg, sassafras, licorice root is pictured here, and then the phytoalexins that are found in many foods. Some of these natural toxicants at specific doses and purities can actually be used as medicinals. Some of these have significant desirable effects if you're a coffee drinker and you drink caffeine. We spoke before in the course about the fava bean alkaloids and the presentation of favism. These alkaloids are visine and convisine. They cause favism in people that have an enzyme deficiency of glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. This happens in some segments, black Africans being one in terms of subpopulations. The presentation of clinical signs include headaches, dizziness, nausea, some yawning, some vomiting, and emesis, abdominal pain, fever. There can be a subsidence of symptoms at this point in time. In some, there'll be a presentation of acute hemolytic anemia, where the actual red blood cells release their hemoglobin, and all kidney problems will follow. These are the structures of the fava bean alkaloids, convisine and visine. Lectins are another category of naturally occurring toxicants we've introduced before. These are proteins or glycoproteins that can bind various types of carbohydrates. In the figure at the bottom of this slide, you can see a coral tree lectin that actually is binding a complexation with lactose in this particular model. Some of this binding capacity of lectins will cause cells to agglutinate or clump together. This is not a good thing in terms of human health. There are some blood type assays in terms of the hemagglutination assays that look at the clumpiness of your blood, if you will. What the mode of action in terms of lectins, it's not particularly well understood. It appears to decrease nutrient absorption from intestinal cells. There are over 800 species of plants that are lectin sources. We also get them from animal tissues. Some of the sources include black beans, soybeans, lima beans, and kidney beans, the example I used in a previous lecture. Some of the problems associated with lectins in terms of because they interrupt nutritional transport, they can cause growth retardation from consumption of the raw product. Some of these are very toxic. You probably have heard of ricin in these days of terrorism and potential for chemical warfare. Ricin is a lectin that comes from the castor bean. The rat LD50 is 0.05 milligrams per kilogram or 50 micrograms per kilogram. It's highly toxic phytochemical. It's responsible for growth retardation in cases where 0.5 to 1% of the diet is black beans or soybeans. Heating will destroy toxicity, and as we spoke before, uncooked or undercooked beans can be a source of lectin toxicity. The mechanism of action for lectins, it's unknown. There seems to be a complex mode of action in terms of leading to disease. We do know that there is an action where it prevents nutrient uptake. There's apparent gut flora involvement, and there apparently is an immune component, perhaps in terms of an allergic sort of response and progression of disease. What this does is give us finally at least a look into the presentation of disease and then the follow-through in terms of determining the causation of that disease from a naturally occurring toxicant. This gives us a little bit of a way to sort of understand the balance of naturally occurring chemicals in the human food chain with synthetic chemicals that do appear or contaminate the human food chain. It gives us food for thought, if you pardon that image, in terms of the relative importance that the media gives in terms of synthetic chemicals in the human food chain versus some of these naturally occurring. It's hard to blame nature, whereas it's very easy to blame perhaps the manufacturers of synthetic chemicals and perhaps rightfully so, people or individuals or companies that pollute the environment. Next time we'll follow through with more analyses in terms of our explorations and the sources, pathways, receptors, and controls of food toxicology. Until that time, thank you much.